This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 224, was recorded on June 18th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is dedicated to healthcare workers around the world, the true heroes of the COVID-19 pandemic crisis, and is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases. It's time for another Macro Voices crude oil special. Petroleum geologist Art Berman headlines as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss everything from U.S. production dynamics to the price outlook. Then our own Patrick Serezna will expand the conversation in our post-game segment with a chart deck exploring energy equities, natural gas, and other energy markets.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's jump into that S&P 500. We're just a day away from quad-witching. S&P 500 more or less bounced off of its worst levels and is trading sideways more or less around the 3,100 level on the index. What's your take on all of it at these levels?
Well, you know, I was very interested to see Jeremy Grantham on an interview this week calling this bubble the real McCoy, implying that, you know, we're really at the end of the story here. You know, Patrick, Jeremy Grantham is another guy that I would really love to interview because the pattern I'm seeing here is some of the true legendary investors like Stan Druckenmiller and now Jeremy Grantham are calling this bubble, saying, okay, this has got to be it. These valuations are insane in the face of a global pandemic that we haven't really even got our heads around yet. There's a lot of reason to expect a global recession. These equity valuations don't make sense. And, you know, these are really, really famous legends in the market. The thing is, Patrick, I think we've got two possibilities. One is we're in the final innings of the biggest bubble, perhaps, in financial history. Or the other possibility is we've entered a new normal where central banks are just going to keep propping asset markets up over and over again until eventually someday the whole system blows up. Now, if you think that's the new paradigm that we're in, we're still quite a ways away from the whole system blowing up. I don't think we're at that stage yet. So are we at the point where we're really coming to the end of this? What I would love to ask both Stan Druckenmiller and Jeremy Grantham is, okay, by all reasonable measures, you know, this is crazy, but it's been crazy for a few years and it's kept on going. So why should we believe that the old rules are going to apply in this new era that we seem to be in of central bank intervention, seemingly having much more importance to asset prices than economic fundamentals? I'd love to ask those guys that kind of question. So I hope to get that opportunity someday.
All right, Eric, let's move on to the U.S. dollar index because we were incredibly oversold. There was a substantial drop, and that seemed to have bottomed last week, and we've more or less been doing a reflexive rally higher. We're slowly edging toward 98, but not there yet. Is this just a bounce in your mind, or is this a meaningful turn in the dollar?
Well, as you say, all we've seen so far is a reflexive rally off of an oversold condition. Maybe it's just a dead cat bounce and we're headed lower. Maybe it's an actual recovery. I think the measures of that, if we can get back to 99, which was the major support level previously, is that going to become a hard resistance level or are we going to get back above it? A daily close over 99 would suggest to me that this was a panic reaction to the breakout of civil unrest in the United States, driving the dollar lower, and maybe now it's coming back out of the market. On the other hand, if we saw a daily close below 94.50, that would suggest to me that, okay, this was just a dead cat bounce and the weakness is now accelerating in the dollar. So I could see it going either way. But given that it seems like we're on the cusp of a second wave of the COVID-19 crisis really starting to hit the tape, my bet is on a strengthening dollar and weakness in asset prices in the near term.
All right. Well, let's move on to crude oil, which is a special for today. We are trading on the July contracts just under $39 at this moment. What's your take on crude here?
Well, as you say, that's the big topic for the day, so I'm going to leave a lot of it for the feature interview with Art Berman. But let's start with inventory. Since we taped the interview with Art Berman earlier this week, it was before the inventory data came out, analysts were expecting a drawdown on crude oil inventories. Instead, we got a build of 1.2 million barrels nationally. Now, that's in addition to a 1.7 million barrel build on the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. I've had a couple of listener questions saying, you know, Eric, why are you emphasizing the Strategic Petroleum Reserve? The whole idea of the crude oil build is it's a build on commercial inventory. Well, the thing is, the game has changed. The oil that's going into the SPR now is not the government buying oil. It's the government leasing the SPR as a storage facility to commercial interests. So even though that oil is not being counted as commercial inventory, it really is commercial inventory. And if you make that correction for the SPR build of 1.7 million barrels, now you've got a net effective commercial build of 2.9 million barrels. Pretty significant build. Now, of course, builds on inventory are normally bearish. And in this case, we got a build to what turns out to be a new all-time record high on U.S. storage. So why is that not super bearish? Well, the reason is because in the finished products, where we've had really big builds on inventory for the last weeks, we're finally seeing drawdowns on the finished product side. 1.7 million barrels on gasoline. Distillates also 1.4 million barrels. Meanwhile, Cushing, Oklahoma is still drawing down 2.6 million barrels this week. I think a lot of that oil is going out of Cushing, finding its way into the SPR. The really big news that was particularly bullish for prices, though, was not the inventory levels, but the U.S. production figure just crashing by 600,000 barrels, more than half a million barrels in a single week, all the way down to 10.5 million barrels. Now, that's from a previous high of 13.2 million barrels, so we're almost 3 million barrels below the high, and I think we're going to get to that 3 million barrels below pretty soon. This is the big kind of drop in U.S. production that I had actually expected a few weeks ago. My guess is it really did start a few weeks ago, and the numbers in the official reported data are just catching up to something that's already happened. Tape action in reaction to the inventory report was, for the most part, entirely bullish, moving a quick pop upside, then a little bit of retrace, then eventually a struggling climb back to higher prices. So short term, I think probably where we're headed now is toward the fill of that gap on the chart, which is at 41.05 on the continuation chart and 41.88 on the contract chart. So somewhere between $41 and $42 is where I'm guessing this rally is going to top out. I think there's probably a pretty strong argument for a pullback there. But the real question is, what happens after that? What's the long-term outlook? The key to that is understanding U.S. production dynamics. How much oil has already been taken offline? How much more is going to be taken offline? And particularly, how easy would it be for all of that idled production to be turned back on? Can they just flip a switch and turn it back on and go back to 13 million barrels? Or is that not possible? Well, needless to say, Art Berman is the man to answer those questions, so we'll save those topics for the feature interview.
Let's move on to gold. And, you know, after that extraordinary rally at the late part of March into early April, where we broke to fresh highs and gold just ripped higher, the last 2 months basically has been this big sideways consolidation where gold just doesn't want to commit lower or higher, and we're coiling up here. What's your take? Is this finally going to resolve itself in the next couple of weeks with a breakout?
I think it probably will, and I think it could go either direction. But my prior conviction, which was really leaning toward a downside correction, because I was saying, folks, we're overdue for a technical correction. Well, as you know, Patrick, as a technician, when you're overdue for a correction, that can resolve either by price movement or by time. And what we've seen is this really long horizontal consolidation. We're putting on a really good base here at 1700. Now, it seems like every time when we test that 1700 base, I get my hopes up. I keep hoping for lower numbers because I want to buy even more gold on the cheap. But 17 has really been holding pretty well. Actually, we get down to 1680 or so intraday. But by the close at the end of the day, 1700 has been holding really well. So if that base continues to hold, it seems to me like the technical argument starts to move more and more in favor of an upside resolution the longer that base is in place. The longer the base, the higher in space.
Eric, let's get to those 10-year treasury yields.
Patrick, there's really been no change in my view, which is to say I don't have a view on the short-term technicals. I've been focusing on the long-term question that I've been asking most of our feature interview guests, which is, are we headed for a secular shift from deflation to inflation? And if so, what does it mean for the bond market? So I'm kind of focused on that. I know you guys at Big Picture Trading do a lot of work on these short-term technicals. So what are you seeing in the chart?
Well, you know, I really thought it was interesting what we saw at the start of June, where we saw those yields skyrocketing from this, you know, when it passed 70 basis points and was it looked like 1% was just right in reach. And then the market just gave it all back. And what I find fascinating about this is that we're trading more or less right at the bottom end of that range that was established right through the bottoms back in March all the way till now. And one of the things that what I've noticed from an intermarket perspective is that the bond market in the past has often led the way of the equity markets, including, for instance, we saw yields starting to decline back in January of 2020, just a month before the stock market started to really move. And so the fact that the yields are working their way lower has got my attention. I don't want to say that I'm forecasting something by it right now, but I'll tell you, if we continue to see, in spite of the fact that rising crude oil, which tends to be very inflationary in its nature, if we see yields continuing to erode and 10-year bonds continue to do very well, it may be a canary in the coal mine that something is going to turn in the equity markets. And so I think this is something you don't take your eyes off in the coming weeks.
Well, I agree with that, Patrick. And, you know, if you think about what we're seeing in the dollar index starting to turn up, you know, it all sort of follows a pattern, as you say, of maybe we're at the cusp of another wave down in equities, driven by what should have been obvious, because it frankly has been obvious, which is the second wave of the coronavirus crisis is upon us. And you look at how the first wave went. You know, we had Italy starting to go absolutely crazy and even Spain starting to go crazy, but it hadn't started in the United States yet. So everybody just ignore it and pretend there's no problem. I think if you go back and look at those charts, we were getting clues in the dollar and in bond yields before the move really happened in the stock market. So I think you're onto something there.
That's right. Anyway, so this week's featured interview guest is petroleum geologist Art Berman. So Eric, why did we invite Art back as a guest this week?
Well, Patrick, it's because out of pure selfish interest, I can't wait to talk to Art to get some perspective on the mechanics of the physical market. Because frankly, I read a lot of research from a lot of big name crude oil people. And, you know, a lot of these financial crude oil analysts are guys like me who think they know about this stuff, but they don't actually work in oil fields. They're not the hands-on guys like Art who actually drills oil wells for a living. And I read one guy who says, you know, look, there's a whole bunch of wells that have been shut in and plugged with concrete plugs that would have to be drilled through. There's no way to easily turn them back on. There's a huge cost associated with restarting wells that have been shut down. Then I read other analysts who say, look, the latest technology that's used in shale drilling, really, it's a couple of taps on an iPad or an iPhone screen to restart some submersible pumps. Those wells can be restarted as easily and also be shut in just a few taps on a touchpad screen. It's simple, it's trivial, it doesn't cost anything at all. So which is it? Who's right? And more importantly, all of this idled production, can it easily be turned back on? Can we get back to 13 million barrels a day of U.S. production if we need to? Or are there serious hurdles in the way? It's been really hard for me to figure that out reading the Wall Street version of the crude oil market experts. So I wanted to talk to Art and find out how this stuff really works. But Patrick, before we dive into the feature interview with Art, I want to ask a favor of our listeners. We've fallen completely off of the radar screen for Apple Podcasts and iTunes. We used to be the top investing podcast out there, and now we've gone to being nobodies. And frankly, this is just because the other podcasts are asking their listeners to rate and review them on Apple Podcasts or iTunes. So please help us out. Write us that 5-star review that'll help get us back to our status of being one of the top, if not the top, investment podcasts. All you have to do is open podcasts in the iTunes store. Find Macro Voices. You can just type it into the search box. Then click on ratings and reviews, where you can give us 5 stars and write a review. It's that simple. You'll also find these instructions in your research roundup email. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In recent weeks, we've been reminded of the fragility of world financial markets and how quickly sentiment can shift from risk on to risk off. Once again, the mantra of buy the dip and the determination of central banks will be put to the test. But as Chris Cole recently told us, the best approach to investing in the long run is very different from what's worked best in recent decades. To help Macro Voices listeners navigate an uncertain future, Niels Kastrup Larsen, host of the Top Traders Unplugged podcast, has created a guide to the best investment books of all time. You can get a free copy at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your research roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Art is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is petroleum geologist Art Berman. Art, I am so looking forward to this one. We're overdue to have you on the program. Welcome back.
Thanks, Eric. Good to be back.
I got to tell you, Art, I am become convinced that most of the analysts in the oil and gas space are guys like me who are fascinated with oil and gas but have never been to an oil field in our lives and don't really know what the hell we're talking about when it comes to the actual mechanics of drilling oil wells and production and how all of this stuff really works at the physical level. Now, what I can tell you, what I do feel very confident that I understand, is although I don't think it's going to happen as soon as a lot of people are assuming, at some point, you know, we're going to have a recovery. We're going to need to resume producing U.S. oil as much as we can. And I just get so many different analyst interpretations, and I think some of them are very misinformed. Some people are saying, look, you know, we were at 13.2 million barrels of U.S. production. We have that capability. We got to push a few buttons, throw a few switches. We can turn it right back on, and we're right back there. Other people are saying, no, there's aspects of the way this whole supply destruction event as a result of the coronavirus has gone down, that it's going to be hard to ever get back to those levels. And frankly, I don't think that a lot of people who are outside of the physical oil patch really know what they're talking about. Now, Art, as a petroleum geologist, you actually drill oil wells for a living. So what I'm hoping to get out of this conversation is a much better understanding of how much oil production was taken offline in the U.S., how much of it is really still offline, because I'm hearing a lot of reports that a lot of it's getting turned back on already, despite the fact that we are, by some measures, running out of storage. And I want to get to an understanding of, are we really able to just ramp things back up to where they were, or are there challenges that are going to make that really difficult? So you and I talked about this off the air and in your usual form, because you're very good at doing this for your consulting clients, you pulled together a slide deck to address all of these issues. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says looking for the downloads. Art, let's go ahead and dive right in here on page 2. You're showing us what's going on with the OPEC Plus production cut and the spring rally. Talk us through the slide deck.
Yeah, Eric. I mean, the important thing about the slide deck is to understand that the price rally that we are, I think, pretty much done with is one of six price rallies that the market has been through since the middle of 2018. And every one of them has failed for the same reason, and that is that there's fundamentally too much oil in the system. The only reason that that price ever goes up is because OPEC Plus has been consistently cutting production since the end of 2016. And so they're keeping it within, you know, some kind of artificially maintained limit at which price can rise. But the market really knows there's a ton of oil sitting out there. So the latest rally was really just, you know, when you're at zero, there's only one way to go. And so basically everybody was short in the market, and it had to come back to some level that was much, much higher than zero, which it did. And then the market realized apparently late, you know, like late last week, oh my goodness, things are not really any different than they were before. We got coronavirus, we got too much oil. And so now prices are adjusting downward. That's the essence of slide two.
Art, I want to ask you about the time spreads on the WTI curve. We're looking here on slide two at a flat price rally. But the other thing that's not shown here is the time spreads, the difference between the July and the August contract. You know, when we were at the bottom there at 37.63, the May to June contract expiration, we were, you know, we got to $60 of price difference from one contract to the next, which was an all-time record. There were sustained periods of weeks at a time when we were at $5 or $6 of price difference between one contract and the very next contract 1 month later. Now, that price differential is a proxy for the cost of storage. The thing is, and it's an inverse, as the time spread goes down, it means that the cost of storage is going up. Just as prices have rallied, time spreads have rallied to the point where right now, as we're speaking on Monday morning, the July to August WTI crude oil time spread is about 29 cents of contango. That's typical of a fairly normal, regular market as you come into expiry for one of these time spreads, you know, 30 cents of contango. That is not an exceptional condition. But just last week, we had an EIA report that said we just hit an all-time record on U.S. storage levels. So if the time spread is a measure or a proxy for the cost of storage, how is it possible that we're seemingly, you know, we're using up more storage than we've ever used up before? The price was reflecting a huge premium for fear of running out. Seems like not only is there no fear of running out, but what the prices are telling us is the market is expecting that storage level to be drawn down dramatically very soon. Is that, am I interpreting that right? Is that what's happening, and why is it happening?
Yeah, it's a mystery, Eric, because it is true that, you know, that we have avoided, you know, the tank top crisis that many analysts thought was inevitable. I certainly didn't rule out that it could have happened, but I was, you know, I'm kind of a pragmatist, and I say, well, has this ever happened before? The answer is no, it never happened before. Why didn't it happen before? Because market forces took care of it for us. I don't believe the market is always right, but the market is always ruthless. And negative $37 on futures prices, I think, sent the signal home loud and clear. And so production was cut. The crisis was averted temporarily. Why does the market think that there's just no problem going forward, which, you know, is your point? And the answer is, I think it has to do with the fact that Cushing inventories are going down. Never mind the fact that Gulf Coast is going up correspondingly. But to my way of thinking, there are two very important factors that are going on that nobody's talking about very much. The first is Strategic Petroleum Reserve. So the federal government opened up certain volumes of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to people to lease and put their crude in. And there's no way to know this, but I think that a lot of the crude oil at Cushing is going into various salt caverns and whatnot of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. So that's bringing down Cushing storage volumes. Overall, you know, we're at like 80% of U.S. capacity, which isn't great, but it's not terrible. The other thing, and this is much more obscure, I believe, and that is this whole business of unaccounted for oil. And so unaccounted for oil is simply produced oil that isn't entering into the flow, isn't entering into pipelines, isn't entering into storage. And so where is it going? And the answer is no one knows for sure, but I'm pretty confident that it's being stored in tanks on leases, which are considerable. I mean, that those facilities have expanded tremendously since 2015, 2016. So what we've been seeing consistently every week for the last 7 weeks is negative unaccounted for oil, which means that oil's being produced, but it's not going onto the market. That is a complete reversal of the trend for basically almost the last 3 years, where every week about 3.5 million barrels are entering the market that are supposedly unaccounted for, meaning they were produced in some previous period. Now the opposite is happening. So between the volumes that are going into the SPR and the volumes that are produced but being withheld on leases, if that's the correct interpretation, we've got a fairly substantial volume. So there's kind of a choke, if you will, on storage building up. How far can that go? Well, you know, the Department of Energy is going to at some point fairly soon have to tell people, okay, we're going to make some more space available in SPR, or we might revisit the crisis. Who knows?
Art, there's a really important issue that I want to make sure we really get into because, frankly, I'm convinced a lot of finance guys don't understand it. The perception in a lot of finance circles about oil is this. Look, we had 13.2 million barrels of U.S. production before the crisis started. Now we're down to 11 million barrels per day of total U.S. output. And the reason, or I should say the perceived reason on Wall Street, is because a bunch of these shale operators were forced to shut in wells, about 2 million barrels per day worth of production. They turned a bunch of switches off and left them off. The perception is those oil wells that were shut in are still shut in. That's the reason that we're down to 11 point whatever it is, million barrels per day. And the assumption I think a lot of people are making is those switches could be turned back on and we could be back up to 13 million barrels if we just turned those oil wells that were shut in and turned them back on. Tell me what's wrong with that story.
Well, like most stories, Eric, there's some truth to it or it wouldn't stick, right? So here's the problem. Shale, tight oil, is a little bit more than 50% of U.S. production. So what about the other 45%, which is obviously nearly half? So, you know, we're ignoring whatever happens to the other half. And that turns out to be important because the other half are conventional wells. And all of the Wall Street assumptions about, you know, what does it take to kill, that's the very technical oil field term, to kill a conventional well, are mostly true. So it's not a trivial exercise. It's, you know, easy enough to do, but, you know, you're doing something which can be reversed, but certainly not with the flip of a switch. And so the question then becomes, how much of that production will come back on? So several, you know, let's just say for round numbers, let's say 1 million barrels or 0.75 million barrels a day is what is called stripper production. Okay. Those are wells that produce very small volumes of oil every day and probably a lot of water. And so the problem there is that at current oil prices, even though they're way above zero, they're still not at $35 or whatever we're at WTI at the moment. Those wells are still not commercial. And the little operators that play with those, they just don't have the deep pockets to be, you know, unplugging and plugging and, you know, going back and forth as the market goes up and down. So initially, that's all EIA was measuring, were stripper wells going offline. So that's one little parcel of reality. The second is the shale wells. And the shale wells are different because they produce from fractures, because they're, you know, they're more recently drilled, they're higher volume, they have higher pressure. And the truth is that for all of the potential problems that could have emerged from shutting them in and leaving them shut in for a long time, most of those wells are back online. So that shut in for shale wells, you know, was maybe a week or two. Prices came back up enough that operators, you know, the storage crisis apparently went away. Almost all of those shale wells are back online. So what will the effect be on production? Well, it's going to go back up. It's definitely going to go back up. I don't think it's going to go to 13 million barrels a day, but I think it's going to go to, you know, it's going to go north of 11 for sure. It's going to go up into the 11 to 12 range over probably June and July. So we basically had 1 month of constrained production that was really a matter of a couple of weeks.
Okay, but the point that I think is not so obvious to a lot of people is the shale wells that were turned off, there's not spare capacity to turn them back on because they've already been turned on. They're already running. And the stripper wells that were turned off are probably staying off. It sounds like it's not going to be economical anytime soon to turn those things on. So the ability of the industry to respond, hypothetically, if demand were to recover just suddenly overnight, which I do not predict, I don't think that's coming for at least 6 months longer than most people are assuming. But when it does happen, it's going to happen quickly. The ability of the industry to just, you know, push a few buttons and ramp back up to 13 million barrels, you're saying that ain't happening.
That ain't happening. So let's take a look quickly at slide number six. Slide number six shows horizontal tight oil wells in the Permian Basin. And, I could have bored everybody with three or four slides, but this is the biggest volume. So let's just look at it. And what I'm showing here is by year of first production, what the decline rates of each one of those, you know, 2018, 2019, 2020 group of wells is. And so this is what happens if you don't drill any more wells. And there's a table which people can refer to. There are two key points I want everyone to take away. The first is that these shale wells decline at about 30% a year on average. Permian's 27 and Bakken and Eagle Ford are a little higher. So it averages out at about 30%. So if you don't drill any more wells, then tight oil production goes down 30% in the first year. And if you look at the second column, which is the annual decline rate, what you see is that in general, the decline rates of the more recently drilled wells are higher than they were in the past. So for instance, 2018, those wells are declining at almost 50% a year. So what does that mean? Well, that means that for all the wonders of technology and, you know, more proppant and more frack stages and longer laterals and all of that, the wells are not finding bigger reserves. They're producing them more quickly. So we get bigger rates and we're getting higher decline rates. And so the good news is we have a lot of oil available to us in the short term. The bad news is it goes away quickly. So, you know, that's a real important takeaway. So that's the scenario if we don't drill any more wells.
Art, let me interrupt you there because I want to ask a question about these decline rates. Clearly, these things, if they're producing, you know, okay, so you drill the well in 2016, you know, after the first year at 21% or whatever the number is, the production has gone down. Now, let's suppose that I've got an expected decline rate of 30% per year. Now, I shut the well in because of the coronavirus crisis, and I leave it shut in for a year. When I turn it back on a year later, does that mean it's producing at 30% less because that annual decline rate is still, you know, happening because of some geological thing that's going on underneath the ground? Or is that, no, you know, you paused it. So you go back to right where you were. You didn't lose anything because no oil was coming out of the ground during that period, so no decline occurred. How does it work?
It's the second one, Eric. Now, we can argue about, I mean, if you actually have it shut in for a year, are there complications that could arise that would cause it not to come back right away or without some remediation? So if you park your car in the garage for a year and don't use it, and then you say, okay, let's go start it up, you know, maybe it'll start right up, or, you know, you may actually have to replace the battery, or, you know, you may even have to tow it into the shop because, you know, it needs something else. So to make it simple, the great likelihood is that most of those wells, with some remediation, you know, taking it into the shop or getting a new battery as the analog goes, most of those wells can be recovered. But the answer is that when you shut in any kind of well, it's not a shale well, it doesn't keep declining. The decline is depletion. It's the result of producing more oil and gas and reducing the pressure. It's a pressure phenomenon. So if you shut the well in, you're not extracting any more oil. In fact, the pressure is going to build up because it's capped. And so when you first unload or uncap that well, the initial production rate will be higher than it was when you shut it in because you've allowed the pressure to build up. So, you know, that's the simple answer. There are complications, but that's the simple answer.
Thanks, Art. I wanted to clarify that. I apologize for sidetracking you there. Let's go back to slides 3 and 4 before I interrupted you and talk about this whole question of, okay, we're at 11 million barrels per day. Can we go up from here? Are we going down from here? What comes next?
Sure. Well, let's take a look at slide number 3. And what slide number 3 shows is the tight oil rig count, which is a proxy for total production, future production. That's in blue. And then lagged tight oil production, which is in orange. Now, this is a key point that because of the advances in technology, mainly pad drilling, which is to say, you know, we can drill 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 wells with the same rig on the same drilling pad. Because of that, the delay between drilling a well, in other words, putting a rig on, and first production is much, much longer now because you need to drill all those wells. Let's just say it's 10 wells per pad. You need to drill 10 wells before you bring the frac crews in to frac 10 wells, which also takes time. And when you're all done with that, then you can start producing oil. And so the empirical fit of these curves, believe it or not, is about 12 months. Now, I went back and, you know, did some fact checking and actually looked at the time from rig on to first oil. And in fact, it varies, of course, with the length of the lateral, the number of wells on a pad, but it does average something around, you know, 300, 325 days. So this is accurate. So, you know, we talk a lot about, oh, isn't the technology great? Yeah, it's great, but it has a cost, as I've always said. And here the cost may be dollars, but it's time. So what we see then is, you see where it says shut in wells just below the March 2020 production. So that's what happened when there was a crisis with storage being filled. And so we went from 7 and a little bit of tight oil production, which corresponded to 12 and a little bit for US, down to 6 and a little bit for tight oil, which corresponded to 11. And now we're in that reactivation stage, okay? And it may be faster than I've shown it there. I don't know, but that's what I've shown. And so what that means is that as those wells are, the shale wells are reactivated in this month, next month, maybe the coming month, production's going to climb back up. But the other very important thing that's going on is if you look down at the bottom of the blue curve down in the right-hand corner, we're at 165 tight oil rigs right now. That's the average for June. We need about 500 rigs running to maintain production at 11 million barrels. And we need 600 or so to maintain production at what corresponded to 13,000 barrels a day that you've referred to. Okay, so at 165, there's no way in the world that we can get back to 13,000 barrels a day of U.S. production for a long, long time. We have to build that rig count back to 500 or 600 from 165, and we got to drill all those wells, we got to frack all those wells before it finally comes back up. So the presumption that you can just flip a switch there and we're back, we might get back short term to something approaching 12 million. But we are in deep doo-doo as far as a country trying to rebuild our production. And that began long before coronavirus. I mean, that process was starting 18 months ago when the rig count started dropping. So that is something that is just not appreciated.
Art, as I listen to you speak, I'm kind of forming a price map or a roadmap in my mind of where this is going. It sounds to me like we do have the ability to push a few buttons, get some production back online quickly, which I suspect is already happening because of the price rally. I think we're going to find that the coronavirus crisis is not over after all, and that this was all too much too fast. And so I think that what's going to happen is we're going to find ourselves with too much oil again, and I won't be surprised if we have a round two of the fears about storage becoming a serious problem. But it sounds like that could mean another wave lower of oil prices, not to minus $40, but maybe back down to $20 to $25. Sounds very realistic to me. But then sometime after that, when we really do need to go back to 13 million barrels in order to address a bona fide full recovery of demand after this health crisis really and truly is over, it sounds like we're basically screwed. It ain't going to happen.
That's exactly right. And I'm 100% with you, Eric. I mean, the last time I was on the show, I think it was in late January, the question then was, is coronavirus a big deal or not? Because most of the world, at least outside of China, thought it was not. And as I remember, you and I were in frighteningly close agreement that it's a huge deal. And it's a huge deal for oil production, not just for public health. And, unfortunately, we were right. And so I'm agreeing with you again, 100%, that just because people are out and driving around in their cars and, you know, going to restaurants without face masks, and, you know, I was in that situation this weekend, kind of scary, it ain't over. You know, as some of the health experts, this fellow from University of Minnesota, I mean, he says we're in the second inning of a 9-inning game. Now, maybe that's pessimistic, but, you know, it doesn't really matter if we're in the second or the fourth or the fifth inning. There's a whole lot more game to play, and no matter what the score is right now, it can change and it will change. So, yeah, we're screwed, Eric. I mean, we are screwed for being able to get back to levels that we have very recently thought were expected, and we've been screwed for a long time because of the declining rig count.
Moving on to slide 4, which looks at some of the lag periods inherent to the rig count versus production, let's talk about how long we're screwed for. Let's imagine that you and I are right, and what comes next is maybe another wave down in prices because we realize that we've gotten ahead of ourselves. But let's suppose, for just the sake of round numbers, that about a year from now, June of 2021, we get to the point where there is a viable vaccine for the virus that really allows the economy to go back to full swing, and we really need to get back to 13 million barrels, or by then, perhaps 14 million barrels a day of U.S. production. When we say we're screwed, how screwed are we? How long would it take for the industry to react to that increased demand and really ramp up to meet that demand? And I particularly say how plausible is it? Because I think the last time we went through this, where we got from whatever it was all the way up to 13 million, it was fueled by this massive investment in the shale patch, which frankly I think was driven by a whole lot of easy money from the Fed. I'm not sure that's going to be there the next time around.
Well, before we leave slide three, I want to call attention to the table. And in the table, under the words, a thought experiment, and let me be really, really clear to you and to all of our listeners that this chart and a couple of the others, I mean, you know, don't take this for the way it's going to be. These are thought experiments. Nobody knows. I mean, we're in uncharted waters here. So, you know, I'm sticking my neck way out and saying, this is what I think is going to happen based on the way these curves have worked before. So notionally, they're correct. Okay. Just don't hold me to the absolute numbers, because I'd be lying to you. And, you know, anybody would be who said they know what's going to happen. But if you look at the table, what I've shown there is in the second column, tight oil production and then U.S. production. And so you can see what those numbers are. And I'm saying that, you know, based on all of this, by the middle of 2021, U.S. production could very well be 7 to 8 million barrels a day, way, way down. Now, look at the far column. That's what EIA thinks. And I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm just saying that even EIA says we're going to be down 3 million barrels from where we were. So how long does it take to build rig count? And so let's go back. Let's go to the next slide, slide number four. And so in slide number four, we can go to about three quarters of the way over to the left, where it says May 2016. We got down to a rig count of 193 when oil prices bottomed out at $30. And it took us until November of 2018, which is to say 2.5 years, to build back from a little under 200 to a little over 600. So that's the kind of build that we need to get ourselves back to anything approaching 12 or 13 million barrels a day. And is there any reason to expect it would take less than 2.5 or 3 years, especially with your comment about the investment capital not being available? No, there's no way to believe that. So, you know, the point of this chart is just that there's a lag also between changes in oil price and a company calling up an oil company, calling a drilling company and saying, hey, you know, we'd like to contract one of your rigs. And so that's about a 4 month lag. And then you've got the 12 month lag about added into that between the time the rig shows up and first oil gets produced. So those are very, very substantial lags. And so it's going to take a long time to get back to the levels that you say, and I agree, we may need. And that's not because of coronavirus. Coronavirus has accelerated and accentuated trends that were already there. The declining rig counts began way before anybody had ever heard of COVID-19.
So it sounds to me, from an investment and speculation standpoint in this market, we're probably peaking out right now on the top of a first wave up in price. There needs to be some kind of a pullback. I don't know if that number is $25 or higher or lower than that, but something less than the $40 that we've almost touched. We actually were above $40 briefly there. As we're speaking on Monday, we're back down to 36 and change. It sounds like we're headed down, and that next down is going to be a buying opportunity, because it sounds to me like maybe there's a few more waves up and down along the way, but eventually we get a moonshot when there is a full economic recovery from this crisis, and the industry is just not able to respond quickly enough. Am I right to think of it that way?
You're totally right. And the question is, what's the timing on that? So let me just lay a couple little pieces in place before I get to that. If we go to slide five, there's a perception that if oil price is $35 or $25, that that's what producers are getting. That's not right. Most of these producers are hedged. And so in slide number five, I'm just showing the forward curves from late December to early January of this year, when we had the Iranian General Soleimani assassinated. We had Iranian missiles attacking U.S. bases in Iraq nearby. And so that was a great opportunity for oil companies to hedge forward. And this diagram simply shows where those price points were for December 20, 21, and 22. So the point is that the companies that hedged intelligently are getting $55 a barrel for their oil right now, not 35 or 25. So that's why they turn them on. I mean, they turned them off because not because they weren't getting enough cash. They turned them off because there was no place to put the oil. So that's slide number five.
Now, hang on a second, Art, because I want to qualify something here. If you were telling me, and I don't think you are, that 100% of all of the shale producers in the United States were hedging 100% of all of their production, and that meant that they could sell all of their oil between $52 and $55. Okay, that would be a totally different equation. That's not the case. So what percentage of the industry is hedged, and what percent of the overall production is hedged that's allowing those producers to sell it at elevated prices?
Yeah, it's a complicated question that I'm not going to try to answer in detail. The simple answer is not everyone is hedged. So for instance, the big players, Exxon, Chevron, they don't hedge at all. It's mainly the small independents, the Conchos, the Diamondbacks, the Pioneers, etc. They're hedged. And what percentage of their production is actually hedged at, let's say, $50 or $55? I don't know, but I'm going to say it's, you know, maybe it's 30%, maybe it's, you know, it's something, it's less than half. But a lot of the oil that they're producing at less was hedged at a different peak. So to really understand that, you've got to go into their investor presentations or their 10K, 10Q, where they reveal all that, but it's according to a schedule. So you're 100% right. Not all of them are hedged. Those that are hedged, some of them are hedged better than others. Not all their production is being sold for $50, but some of it is.
We already talked about slide six, Art, so let's move on to slide seven. Now, when I hear the phrase unaccounted for oil, that sounds like one of those, you know, accounting footnote things where there's some tiny little amount that they couldn't account for. You know, it's like the rounding error that they don't know what to do with. And so they give it a name, like unaccounted for oil, and it doesn't really amount to very much. That's not what we're talking about here. Look at this chart on slide seven. This unaccounted for oil is a lot of unaccounted for oil. How is it possible that so much oil is unaccounted for?
Yeah, it really is a lot. And this is something that very few people even pay attention to. You know, it's a little bit like a production impairment. Okay. I mean, a lot of these companies say, oh, okay, we're taking an impairment or a write down on our reserves, our booked reserves, but don't worry because it's not a cash item in this quarter. Well, okay, fair enough. But it certainly was money that was paid cash for in some previous quarters, so it's not unimportant or trivial. Unaccounted for oil is simply the difference between production and disposition. So I produce a barrel of oil, and if I go ahead and sell that barrel of oil within the week that it was produced, then it's a barrel produced and a barrel disposed, and unaccounted for oil is zero. If I produce the barrel and keep it in a tank battery on the lease and don't sell it in that week, then it's a barrel of unaccounted for oil. Unaccounted for simply means that it didn't go into the market, basically. It didn't go to sales. That's all it means. So it's not a simple adjustment factor. It's a very real number. There's nothing, well, the only mysterious part about it is where this inventory is actually being held. I think the possibilities are quite limited, which is why I think it's on the lease. But the point of this chart is that from the middle of July 2017 until the tank top storage crisis reached a peak in mid-April of 2020, the average unaccounted for oil was a positive 3.3 million barrels per week. Since that tank top crisis, the average has been minus 5.8 million barrels. So this long-term trend has been reversed. And so 35 million barrels of produced oil has been withheld from the market since the middle of April. And then if you go down to the bottom, the yellow or the orange, those are SPR releases, withdrawals, and additions. And what you can see is that something approaching 15 million barrels of oil have gone from somewhere, either the wellhead or storage, into strategic petroleum reserves. So just in the last few weeks, you have the two numbers and you got 50 million barrels. That's a bunch of oil. So this is a very critical thing for people to realize, and it's the reversal. The long-term secular trend of adding more and more unaccounted for oil, that's all gone the other way.
Art, let's move on to slide number 9. What's going on with the Brent WTI spread?
The Brent WTI spread, usually over the last couple of years, Brent is more than WTI, and that works great for U.S. crude exporters because the difference is usually enough to pay for the transport of that oil, you know, to Europe or to Asia. That premium actually went negative for a couple of weeks. And as of last week, the premium was down to almost a dollar. So Brent's a little bit more than WTI. The problem is that by the time you move the oil from Cushing to Houston, put it on a boat and send it, let's say, to Rotterdam, you need something closer to $1.40 to pay for all of that. So at $1.05, export is not commercial. If we go on to slide number 10, that just shows, again, a lagged relationship to U.S. exports. And what you can see is that as the Brent premium has gone down since middle of March, U.S. exports have fallen a million barrels a day. And that's exactly what I would expect. And I anticipate that trend is going to continue. What that means is that less and less U.S. production is going to move out of the U.S. market, and it's going to have to either be shut in or it's going to have to be put in storage.
Art, let's move on to slide 11, and I'm going to ask you to try to explain this slide in a specific context, which is right now, a lot of people in the market, and certainly the price of WTI time spreads is saying, hey, baby, the whole thing about the storage crisis and the tank tops, old story, it's over. There's no problem. Everything's fine. We don't have any problem with storage. Is that true?
No, that's not true at all. Slide 11, this is a comparative inventory slide. We're not going to get into the details. You've said before, people can check it out. But just think of the green as oversupply. That's supply that's going into storage. This shows OECD oversupply. So that includes the United States. OECD, of course, is, you know, all of the advanced countries of Europe and North America and some other places. And what you see is that our level of not just absolute inventory, but comparative inventory is higher than it's ever been. May's number is even higher than the peak levels that we got back in 2016. And the way we got there is an absolute vertical wall. So if anybody thinks that the storage crisis is over, I'll argue with them a little bit about the United States, but the global problem is absolutely not over.
Let's put a little more context around this, Art, because the only thing I can conclude here, you know, at some point we had a panicking market where the specific fear that drove contango to those crazy levels that we saw in the middle of April was a fear not just of a lot of oil, but running out of storage so that there might be no place left to put the oil that was being produced. That fear went to stark raging terror around the 20th of April when everybody just completely freaked out on that May contract expiration. since then, it seems like what's going on, at least what the prices in the market are telling us, is somehow analysts have concluded that we're not ever going to get to the point of running out of space. That, yeah, okay, we got a lot of storage and it's still building. But somehow, apparently, the analysts have decided we're not at risk of running out of space. Do you think that the analysts are right about that? Or do you think that that's maybe just a reverse of the pendulum swing, so to speak, from what we had at the end of April?
Well, Eric, those same analysts were the ones that were telling us in January the coronavirus wasn't a problem for the world economy or the oil market outside of China. So obviously, I respect those analysts. They're smart guys, men and women. But just because they say something, look at their track record. They've been dead wrong very recently. So, I can't tell you why I come to a different conclusion. I'm looking at data. I don't know what they're looking at.
And based on the data that you're looking at, what is the degree of risk in your mind of a situation where we get to a necessity to do another round of panic shut-ins because we're running out of storage capacity in the United States and we have to go through another panic drill of just shutting down oil wells because the production coming out of them, there's no place to put it?
I think the probability in the United States is relatively lower than it was 2 months ago because we've been through it once before. So producers are looking at it real carefully. They know they were able to do it once. They can do it again if they need to. In the world, I have no way to answer the question. That really comes down to what the big exporting nations decide to do. And we've seen that compliance inside of OPEC is questionable. Everybody's desperate. The Iraqi government can't pay half of its government employees, according to some people. So if oil goes up a little bit, their production's going to go up. But bottom line, Eric, we're not out of the woods on any of the concerns that have arisen since the coronavirus became a crisis.
Art, let's move on to slide 13. Now, if I look at prices in both the stock market and the oil market, it kind of looks like, hey, V-shaped recovery, baby. We're pretty much back, not quite. We're approaching $40. We were above $40 before this started, but we're almost back to where we were before the crisis started. Does that mean that we're almost back to consumption that we had pre-crisis or anything close to it?
No way, Eric. That is the popular misconception based on, I don't know, but I look at data, and what slide 13 shows is data. And this is weekly EIA consumption data that I've averaged over 2 weeks because of a lot of reasons, but you've got to average it somehow. And what it shows me is that the recovery, such as it is almost 100% gasoline. So gasoline consumption has gone up a little more than 2.5 million barrels a day from the low in mid-April. But everything else is still languishing at pitiful levels. And the one that concerns me the most is distillate, because distillate in blue, that's diesel. And diesel is the barometer of economic activity. So if we're not using diesel, that means that there are no orders for heavy, heavy durable goods that require ship, train, or truck transport. And so diesel consumption is up a little bit. It's up, 0.7 million barrels on average, 700,000 barrels a day from what it was at the low. But until diesel starts moving up, I say the recovery is superficial. It's people driving around in their cars, either because they're bored or because they're afraid to take public transport or a little bit of both. I mean, the real question you ask is, how many of those people in cars are driving to work? Because other than that, it's not economic activity that's productive. So again, glad to see it. That's great. But we're still 20% overall consumption below the 5-year average of 20 million barrels a day. We're at 16. So we got a long way to go to get back to where we were.
Now, Art, you have become recognized in the industry, perhaps first and foremost, for your comparative inventory price modeling system, which has been just remarkably accurate at forecasting crude oil prices. In the interest of time, listeners, what we had to do for this week's interview, I really wanted to focus the conversation on the developments that we've already discussed. So for those of you who were already expert on how the Art Berman comparative inventory system works, all of the data that you need for the update you were probably looking forward to getting from Art in this interview is in the slide deck starting on page 14. For those of you who don't know what we're talking about, I encourage you to go back and listen to some of Art's earlier interviews, the first interviews that he did on Macro Voices. Just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com, type Art Berman into the search box, look for some of those early interviews where we described and discussed how the comparative inventory system works. Or better yet, Art, you know, in the beginning, you just had this system that you used. You shared it with our listeners. It's gotten so popular because it's been so accurate that you've kind of productized it, and you're now offering a service. Tell us briefly before we close about that service.
Right, Eric. Well, I offer a weekly U.S. comparative inventory and oil storage report, which is published every Wednesday right after or as short after as possible. The EIA storage report, and it gives you all the insight into comparative inventory, consumption, you know, what's up, what's down. And you can get that if you get it for a year, it's $10 a week. I don't see how that could be beyond anybody's budget that is serious about understanding oil markets. So artberman.com, you can get the comparative inventory and oil storage report.
And in the interest of time, we're going to leave it there, but I strongly encourage our listeners to check out the rest of the slide deck where you'll find an update on the comparative inventory price modeling forecast. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Art. You know, it's one of those things where inside of me, I've always anticipated that at some point there will be an energy bull market that will come out on the other side of this. But really how things resolve themselves for the remainder of 2020 is one of the big puzzle pieces to solve on the short term. What did you take away from the interview?
Well, the big question mark in my mind after thinking through everything I discussed with Art is, okay, what happened last time? A whole bunch of people, myself included, were naysayers on shale because we said the decline rates of shale wells, the economics of shale wells, are just not what a lot of people thought that they were. And I'm going back to 2010, 11, 12. I thought that the shale revolution was not really going to happen the way it did. I thought that shale was going to disappoint the market in terms of how much oil it could produce. And I thought that that meant oil prices were going higher. Needless to say, I got that one wrong. Well, what about this time? I want to say, okay, the reason that that whole shale revolution happened, it's not so much about new technology. This technology has been around for a long time. What it was really about was a mountain of easy money in the form of junk bond financing for all of these shale drillers to go and drill a lot of wells, and as much as it produced an incredible amount of oil, which is a phenomenal testament to American engineering know-how. You know, at the end of the day, they didn't make a whole lot of money in those investments. And so I thought next time around, there's not going to be this wall of money. But look at what we've been seeing in markets where, in reaction to weakness in the market and the COVID-19 crisis, it seems like the Fed is just going into high gear and going crazy on expanding its balance sheet. So is there going to be a second wall of money? Who in the world on Wall Street would be dumb enough the second time around to finance a bunch of junk bonds for the shale patch? Well, nobody has to, because they can float those junk bonds and sell them to the Fed. I mean, the Fed's buying junk bonds. So I don't know. I think that the financing, the question of whether or not there will be that same huge amount of financing available to the shale industry, is what's going to determine whether we see just a modest rise in prices or if we get the really big moonshot in prices that Art and I discussed. Anyway, Patrick, let's move on to the chart deck. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. It says Big Picture Postgame Chart Book. Patrick, energy charts. Talk me through what's going on here. Starting on page two, you're looking at WTI crude oil futures in the July contract.
Right. Well, Art did a great job explaining what was going on in the crude oil markets, and you dissected it so very well. But I wanted to really take a look at all of the energy markets, gasoline, nat gas, and everything, and just see where the entire energy space, including equities, were. The only observation I wanted to make on page two was simply that, well, we had an incredibly oversold oil market, and right now we have more or less 50% retraced the huge sell-off that happened since the start of 2020. And often when you have a very oversold condition, the reflexive rally on the other side often will retrace about half of what the prior drop was. So this is almost par for the course for even in a bear market of what something will happen. So what I think is going to be the most interesting is what oil actually does from here. Because if it's a real bull market in oil that's going to launch from here, it should be able to clear 40 decisively and work its way higher. And if this is where it stalls, then it's really hard to make an argument that that the bull market has started yet. It doesn't mean it won't, but it's just it's a level that I think is very relevant for us to watch what happens here.
Patrick, I've been dying to ask you, since you're the technician in the house, what you think about the gap fill. You know, there's such a mantra in technical analysis that gaps have to be filled, although I'm not sure that there's any reason it happens other than people think that it should happen. Now, if we look at the continuation chart, the gap fill level is about 41.05. On the July contract, which is just about to expire, we're looking at 41.88 as the top of that gap fill. On the August contract, I think it's around 42.25 or so. Do you think that that is going to act as a magnet to pull the price up? Would it make sense to look at that as a target before this market rolls over, if it's going to roll over the way Art thought it might? How do you see that here?
I think you nailed it with when you were referencing that most traders that are observing it, it almost becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, where if enough traders are looking for the same price level by it being the focal point, and a lot of times it will actually fill the gap. I tend not to trade those moves myself, because I think that there's better ways of targeting things. But it would not be a shocker if we saw oil temporarily trade up there just to fill that gap and then give it back. I mean, it would start to look like a pattern of almost like a little head and shoulders pattern if we saw the gap fill and then gives it all back on the other side. I don't have any high conviction if it will happen or not, but it is something that is very widely being tracked. And whenever something is being tracked that much, it's something we have to pay attention to.
Patrick, let's move on to RBOB gasoline futures on the next chart, seeing maybe a brisker recovery there and maybe a little bit more consistent trajectory to the upside. What do you make of this chart?
Well, interesting, because it does also have a gap that it's filling, that like you were mentioning, which would have a gasoline head to about 140 if that gap was filled. But gasoline has pretty consistently since the bottom been outperforming oil, and the relative strength is very much there. We've already just broken to a slightly higher high, and so momentum is there. There's a lot of talk of driving season, summer driving season, pushing gasoline demand demand and crack. We'll talk about cracks. Actually, we can move on page four there as well. There's the crack spreads, which is the spread for refining oil into gas, which is back to a relatively healthy range. I mean, over the last, you know, 5+ years, we've seen crack spreads gravitate between this kind of $8 to $10 bottom end of the range and $20+ on the upper boundary of the range. And while we saw those crack spreads hit zero during the actual oil crash, we're back to ranges where refiners are profitable again in doing this. And so this is one of the really interesting puzzle pieces to solve. Is gasoline going to recover quicker and stronger? And you know, Art talked about that on one of its charts. And right now, there's no denying the relative strength belongs to gasoline when compared to oil. And that will probably continue. What I do, though, want to work into is page five, where while gasoline has certainly outperformed oil, the one market that has not at all and actually is quite underperforming is natural gas. And it's really interesting because natural gas popped back in April, May, based upon this idea that with the capping of all of these wells, that a lot of the oversupply issues would have been solved. But what is clear at this stage is, at least what the price is showing is that oil prices didn't stay low enough, and not enough wells were shut off in order to really change the supply dynamics in the natural gas market. So here I have the July contract breaking to a fresh low, and the trend is so ugly. It's just down, you know, it's moving from the top left to the bottom right of the chart, and it's just ugly, right?
Well, it's just ugly, but any time that I see a futures chart looking this ugly, it always forces me to ask a question, which is, okay, this is the July contract. What's the August contract doing, and what are the subsequent contracts doing? And so let's move on to page six, where you're showing the term structure, which is the map of what all the subsequent contracts are doing in price. And boy, I guess my intuition was right on. There's a huge, huge contango. What's going on there?
Well, I mean, you can see the waves, which is the typical seasonality, which prices in those higher winter prices in that gas. But what is amazing is the complete collapse of these summer contracts, like this July, August, September contracts are all very, very weak. But then it's almost like an explosive steepening, or at least moving up on the curve, where the December contract is almost double that of what this front month July contract is trading at. This is absolutely fascinating that we see this contango exist, considering that in the oil market that we are already very flat on that term structure, right? So, Eric, this is where I want to talk about the UNG, which is the United States Natural Gas Fund, or the ETF that actually trades these natural gas futures contracts. And we've had numerous episodes here where we've talked about the oil one, which is the USO. And the USO, to deal with the fact that they're rolling their contracts, is now spread along the term structure, I think even up to a year out, that they're out on some of these contracts. But what I find fascinating is that even in spite of this massive contango that we're seeing, this ETF is still very much a front month ETF, where they are just right now in the process of finishing rolling their July into August contracts. And so that means this ETF, and you can see on the chart just how much it's underperforming that of the natural gas contract itself. And so what's interesting here is that means that if this contango persists, this ETF is going to eat that contango roll as we get here into the third quarter. What's your take on all of this?
Well, Patrick, this just underscores the reasons that I'm so skeptical of these commodity ETFs. You know, you take a market like crude oil, where it's really important to understand the term structure, and you get a whole bunch of mostly lazy retail investors who don't really know what that means and don't care to find out, and they just kind of take a gamble, not understanding the consequences of backwardation and contango and how it affects the roll performance of an investment like USO. Now, USO is a crude oil contract. UNG is natural gas. The natural gas futures contract is known as the Widowmaker contract specifically because the term structure, the contango and backwardation, has caught so many professionals by surprise. It has ruined careers. It has bankrupted funds because unexpected things can happen in the term structure of natural gas that just blows up all kinds of really smart traders. Why in the world, if a lot of oil traders won't touch natural gas futures, and that contract is given the name Widowmaker by futures traders? Because if you don't really know what you're doing, it's so dangerous even for an experienced futures trader to trade it. Why in the world would anybody buy a fund like UNG where they don't even understand the underlying term structure implications on the performance of the investment and the tracking errors that it introduces? It doesn't make any sense to me that anybody buys these things. But as you say, right now, for now at least, UNG is still all centered in the front month contract. What happens if they have some crazy dislocation? Now, if you look at the performance of nat gas versus the performance of crude oil, if we go back for a minute to page 6, look at all of those wild undulations in this chart. The reason for that, as you said a few minutes ago, is because seasonality plays so big of a role in the shape of the natural gas term structure. Just imagine if UNG couldn't stay in the front month and had to push their positions X months into the future. Well, over time, where those contracts would be would either be on the upside or the downside of those really big sawtooth waves in the market. There could be all kinds of profound implications to that depending on how they ended up reorganizing their exposure, if they ever did that. Furthermore, if you're the investor in that fund, you don't have any control over whether they change that allocation or the exchange makes them change that allocation or whatnot. So I don't understand why anybody gets into these. As far as the underlying futures trades here, natural gas, it's called the Widowmaker contract for a reason. You either really, really understand the physical market dynamics of natural gas storage in particular, why it's so expensive and has such a high carrying cost. If you are really expert on that, you can make a killing in this market by understanding and anticipating those shifts in term structure. But if you're not that expert, you don't want to touch the NG futures contract, and that's the reason they call it the Widowmaker.
Right. That's a good segue to then a lot of people are asked the question, well, then how do you play it? And I say that if you aren't someone such as yourself that knows your futures markets and knows how to play it on the term structure, the best thing in generally is for traders, investors, especially at the retail level, just to stick with energy equities. I mean, there's enough correlation in the equity markets on energy stocks to the underlying commodities that you don't need to get into the complexities of how the commodities themselves work in the futures markets. But so that's where I wanted to go with on pages 8, 9, and 10, which is what I have the chart first on the Select Spider Energy ETF to XLE. And at least on this chart, what was interesting was, first of all, how the magnitude of the sell-off, just how ugly that January through to March sell-off really was, where it went from just north of $60 down to almost $20, just a complete and total halving of the ETF. But even though off the low, very similar to how you can express percentages on something like Boeing off of its lows, this ETF doubled in price. I mean, going from basically the low 20s all the way up to $46, $47 on the upside. But what is interesting is that when you really look at the vast majority of equities in the markets, almost all equities outside of financials have mostly recovered back towards those early 2000, well, at least the 2019 levels. And we have not seen any recovery like that in energy. And so while we've had that reflexive bounce, the energy stocks are still very, very cheap. And if oil markets are to improve in the future, maybe they're still trading at a meaningful discount. And maybe this is still a place where one could find opportunities in the future. So next chart, Eric, what I want to look at was the oil service ETF, the OIH. And this one has been extraordinarily volatile. I mean, we went from this thing trading near $280 to it hitting a low down around $65. And similarly, we've saw an extraordinary reflexive rally where it more than doubled, going from 65 hitting a high almost of 170 some odd dollars on the upside. Just a huge rally. The volatility has been considerably higher in this space. And this is interesting to me because in that oil service space, that's really where the big volatility is in terms of whether or not shale will be restarted up again, right? Do you have a take on all of that?
Well, Patrick, we have to remember that in this crisis, what's happened is the frack spread count, that's the number of fracking rigs that are in place and fracturing wells in order to put them into production, just dropped off a cliff. So the companies that are in the business of not actually producing oil, but in providing services to oil producing companies, and that's what OIH is companies that provide services to the oil and gas industry. They're more volatile for all the same reasons that gold mining stocks are more volatile than the price of the metal itself. If nobody is drilling any wells and nobody is fracking any wells, then you don't need the oil services guys, and they end up completely idled and, you know, they start to go bankrupt. But if you listen to what Art said in today's interview, at some point, we're going to get to where we need to try and get back to 13 million barrels per day of U.S. production. And that is not, by any stretch of the imagination, a matter of flipping just a bunch of switches and turning stuff back on. It's about making a bunch of phone calls and calling those companies that are in the OIH and spending lots of money to get them coming in to run their drilling rigs and run their frack spreads and so forth. So eventually, I think OIH is going to do really, really well. But that doesn't mean right away, because we may be going into a second wave where we see a lot of the wells going back and being shut in. And of course, some of those OIH companies, they get a little bit of business out of shutting wells in. But once they're shut in and idled, you know, it's not until we really get to the next wave of drilling new wells and fracking new wells that those guys really start to make money.
Right. And so let's move on, though. What I want to now touch on is how did the exploration and production companies actually do? And again, this is a space that just suffered immensely on the way down. And they've been trending lower all throughout 2019. This wasn't just a break that started in January for this space, but they've also rebounded quite a bit. And it's just a higher volatility basket than the traditional large cap ones. And what's interesting, and finally, the one I wanted to touch on was the oil refiners, the ones that are actually converting the oil into gas and usually have nice dividends and are much more stable businesses. And they've also obviously had a very difficult time throughout March and have recovered very well. And this is where on page 12, what we have is the refiners versus the broader energy. So I just overlaid the XLE with the refiner space. And what we can generally see is the refiners have outperformed and done relatively better in general than the broader energy space. And this is one interesting area that I wanted to touch on. I mean, obviously, if we enter a period where there becomes a shock in the system and let's say some event in the Middle East and the oil prices go skyrocketing because of a shock, then that would be a period where I would anticipate refiners underperforming. But unless we get something of that nature, this might be an interesting storyline. Gasoline's doing very well. Crack spreads are widening again. And refiners may generally be a better place to be. And so one of my interesting ideas to watch over the next couple of months is whether or not sort of a long-short combination of being long refiners against short the broader XLE will work. And that's definitely one of the things that I'm going to be watching.
Boy, I'd love to ask Pat Hemsworth that question. You know, as you were talking, the thing that hit my mind is I think a lot of the reason that the refiners have performed so well is there is a glut of refining capacity in the United States, but there's a deficit globally. And what I would start to think about is, okay, in the future, are we going to see a lot of capital available to build more refineries around the world where the finished products actually get consumed? Because, for instance, in South America, they don't refine a lot of their products. They end up buying finished products like gasoline, and you know, they buy them from somebody like Pat Hemsworth and put them on a ship and send the finished product rather than the crude oil down to those countries. So are those countries going to build their own refineries, or are they going to continue to rely on U.S. refining capacity, which seems to have become a very important export for the United States, is finished products as opposed to just crude oil itself? I don't know enough about it. That's a question for someone like Pat. Let's ask her next time we get her on the program. Meanwhile, Patrick, we don't have Pat on the program this week, but we do have you every single day at Big Picture Trading. So listeners, I want to encourage you again to check out the free trial at Big Picture Trading. You got the details there on page 14. And we're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they missed in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Art, as well as a link to the chart books, both Art Berman shared and the charts we just discussed here in the post game. There's also a link to that Jeremy Grantham interview on CNBC and an interesting article from Chris Whalen about Powell missteps on corporate bond purchases. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com. the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.